Kuan Yin is the embodiment of compassion. Now, some of you are familiar with various statues, rupas of her. Sometimes she's seated with one foot on the floor, and then the other knee is up, and her arm is just extended out, and she's just at ease, looking very poised. And sometimes her posture is called the posture of royal ease. And in the chant, you hear that phrase, resting, rest. I return my life to the one who listens deeply. But she's just there, resting, at ease, listening deeply, listening to the sounds of the world, all the joys and the sorrows. I sometimes think the listening deeply so that she can really hear the what are the causes and conditions that are at play, giving rise to all the dukkha. And because she's in touch with the causes and conditions, like she understands and sees what's at play, there's not any reactivity in her heart. What arises is just this wish to alleviate suffering. And that foot on the floor, some people have said it's her readiness to engage with the world and be a balm and a support for people during their times of difficulty. Remember one time during, I was with this group of practitioners who we were chanting Kuan Yin, just resting, resting deeply. And we had a really challenging time. And we just instinctively knew that we needed to come together and chant that just to meet the turbulence that was passing through the group so that we could meet it with tenderness. And there was something about listening to each other as we were chanting, listening to each other, attuning to each other, holding each other with tenderness. And this is what I love about compassion practice, or just compassion itself. Like, once you have a felt sense of the compassion, you can call it up with a phrase or an image or a chant or even a somatic sense. So, I know some of you have practiced with James Baraz, and he'll often encourage you to just call up compassion by just putting a hand on the cheek, just to feel your own tenderness, your own care. This past week, I was teaching a retreat at Spirit Rock with a really lovely team, lovely group of people. Really blessed to be teaching with them and such a dedicated group of practitioners. There was one woman who came into a practice meeting, was having some challenges, some difficulties. And we started working with compassion. And she instinctively started to just caress her hands as a way to soothe her nervous system. And then I just suggested she put her hand on her heart. She did that, and then she instinctively put her hand on her belly. It's like, we know how to soothe and calm our nervous system when dukkha or pain or the unreliability of life is roiling around us or moving through us. We instinctively know how to meet ourselves with compassion if only we would remember that we have this innate capacity to meet life, to meet the challenges, difficulties with compassion. We live in a dukkha realm. And dukkha is this nuanced word, right? As a noun, it has specific meaning. It talks about dying process and aging and illness being dukkha, getting what we not want, not getting what we want, being dukkha, being separated from the things that we really care about and love. So there's dukkha as a noun, and is also used as an adjective, just meaning painful. There are certain aspects of life that are just painful, yeah. And then there's the fact that things are constantly changing. And because of that fact, that truth of our world, things aren't quite reliable, right? You have health one moment, next moment, you don't have health. Things are kind of going along, and then a global pandemic takes the world. Spreads across the globe, right? Living in a dukkha realm isn't easy. And when we don't have compassion as an ally, the pain and the unsatisfactoriness and the dukkha can gradually start to wear away at our well-being. Right? There's this wonderful, there are some words that speak to the immensity of dukkha. And that because dukkha is so immense, this first noble truth is so immense, that we need to open to it gradually in stages. So this is from Joseph Goldstein. It's said that the reason enlightenment happens in stages is because we don't have the capacity all at once to open to the first noble truth of dukkha, of the suffering, of the unreliable nature of things. So compassion actually helps us to open up to this first noble truth of dukkha without being overwhelmed, without collapsing in despair, without barricading the heart or rushing in to fix a situation or people or outer conditions. And we usually rush in to fix because we haven't quite figured out how to bear and be with our own pain, the pain of our loved ones, the pain of the world. And the Buddha is very, very clear about dukkha, the unreliable nature of things, the pain, the unsatisfactoriness, the suffering. He says it's to be understood, this first noble truth that there's dukkha in the world, not that life is dukkha, but that there's just dukkha. And it's to be understood. It's not to be run from. It's not to be reacted to, although that seems to be our modus operandi. It's actually meant to be understood. And understanding dukkha is predicated on getting close to it. And what allows us to get proximate to dukkha is compassion. Because it's the reactivity that precludes us from actually understanding dukkha. There's the just the pain of having a body sometimes. My mother's got a lot of body pain these days. And I notice there's just the pain that she's experiencing and then her reactivity to the pain. So it's like her reactivity is a buffer between herself and the initial pain. And that reactivity precludes her from actually getting close to it and really starting to. And when we say understand dukkha, we want to understand its qualities and characteristics in such a way that it frees the heart and mind. It frees us from the activity of craving. And by craving, I'm talking about a shorthand. It's a shorthand for this interplay of greed, aversion, and delusion. When we actually start to understand dukkha, all of our reactivity that compounds the dukkha starts to cease, starts to dissolve and fall apart. When I get caught up in my reactivity around dukkha, if I'm lucky, there's a line from a Lucille Clifton poem, and I'm really just loving Lucille Clifton. She's a poet laureate, African American woman, mother, and not a lot of, she's not known, she's not like a household name, but poets know her and poets respect her. And it was actually a poet friend of mine who introduced me to her. I was happy to learn about T.S. Eliot in school, but I also wish that I had learned about Lucille Clifton and had her poems to kind of shore up my heart as a young person, but now I have her poetry. And there's this one line from a poem called Mother Tongue, We Are Dying. And it reminds me that the challenges and the difficulties and the dukkha are just a natural part of life. The line is, no failure in us that we can hurt like this. No failure in us that we can be hurt like this. And in the poem, she's actually talking about the dying and death process, the dying process and finally death. But I like applying this line to just dukkha itself. No failure in us that we can be hurt like this. And her words just remind me that to experience pain, that to experience hardship isn't a personal failing. It's common to everybody. And it helps to just soften my own heart or any resistance or any hardness so that I can start to get close to the dukkha so that I can understand it. Example of this was, seems so long ago now, but at the time it was hard. There was a phone call that I had to participate in, a Zoom call. And it was a four people. I was the fourth person involved, and we really care for each other, right? We've had a long association with each other. And the fact that we needed a Zoom call is an indication of the depth of the ruptures in our relationships among the four of us. So before the call, I'm just noticing, like, dreading this call. But mindfulness was there to reveal how I was relating to this perceived relational difficulty. There's a lot of bracing in the heart. As I said, there was dread. And it was interesting to actually see sloth and torpor. So the hindrance of sloth and torpor coming in, just lowering the energy and kind of going unconscious, wanting to go unconscious. And it was just clear, like, I needed Kuan Yin. I needed to touch into Kuan Yin as a way to summons my own inner compassion. And some of you know I just graduated from a teacher training, and one of the gifts that they gave us was a necklace with Kuan Yin on it. It's carved out of obsidian rock. So I put that on before the call, and I just said, Kuan Yin, I need your help. I need your help. And I was just with the bracing in the heart, coldness in the hands, the dread. I don't want to be on this call. And the low energy, the wanting to check out. And what was beautiful about bringing mindfulness and compassion to what was arising in that moment was I could be with that. And there was some measure of patience. I could be with what was arising without acting it out. And this is what's so essential about practicing with compassion in the midst of dukkha, in the midst of our reactivity, is we want to actually see how we're reacting. And not as a way to berate ourselves, but actually to be there for ourselves so that we don't make our pain through our reactivity somebody else's business. So, no failure in us that we can be hurt like this. no failure in us that we can be hurt like this. I like the us in that statement too. It reminds us that dukkha is common to all, not just humans, but to all living beings. So, excuse me. So I was teaching back east. IMS opened their center, Insight Meditation Society opened their center for the first time since COVID. And it was a joyous, joyous thing to come together with staff and this wonderful teaching team. All the yogis who came, who were willing to, given the conditions and given the COVID precautions, were willing to come and practice for 3 weeks. Very, very special. Like I said, a really joyous thing. So I was teaching back east and I was walking to the retreat center and it had rained the night before. And I notice as I'm walking to the retreat center, there are these fat earthworms on the road. And then the thought arose of like, oh, the ground got saturated with water last night and they were flooded out of their home. And here they are seeking refuge, seeking safety, seeking a higher ground. It's like even earthworms know dukkha. There's like no being that's spared. When compassion isn't actually present, we react, as I said, in different ways to dukkha. Sometimes we blame life or we complain, like, why is this happening to me? We fall into despair. We try to pretend we're okay. And these reactions aren't wrong. And they come from this really innocent place, this innocent movement of the heart that's simply saying, I actually need something to help me navigate all that a human heart and a body are susceptible to. I need something that'll help me just navigate everything that I'm going to encounter in a lifetime. Just talking about the global pandemic a moment ago. We think we've got a handle on things. We're starting to navigate and open things up. And then Delta hits and Omicron hit. All the things that we experience in a lifetime, racial injustice, illness, loss of loved ones, political disruption. I've been really disheartened, is the word, by the just physical assault and dismissal on our queer friends and family, our LGBTQI friends and family. Everything that we encounter in a lifetime, we need something to actually see us through. And compassion is that quality of the heart, that strength of heart that helps us to navigate the challenges so that we can meet it with open-heartedness, with care, with this wish, and perhaps even the will to alleviate suffering where and when we can. As you can see, we'll be exploring compassion tonight because it can be a real ally for us. Phone call, challenges, difficulty, all my reactivity. And I could call on Kuan Yin. I could, as a way to summons my own compassion. Compassion can be a companion for us through our lives. I also want to explore compassion because when it's present, it's an expression of a free heart and mind. And whether you know it or not, each of you have had a foretaste of freedom. What Ajahn Buddhadasa called the temporary nibbana, Seems like an oxymoron because when you read the suttas, they talk about Nibbana being profound, unshakable. But he talks about a temporary Nibbana, and compassion, as I said, is an expression of this free heart and mind. By Nibbana, I just mean a heart and mind that's free of greed, aversion, and delusion. This is from Ajahn Buddhadasa's Buddha for Every Nibbana for Everyone, and it's this slim little volume, and you can actually download it as a PDF. I wouldn't even call it a volume; it's like 15 pages, but it's powerful. And this is what he says about temporary Nibbana. Any reactive emotion that arises ceases when its causes and conditions are finished. So he's talking about codependent arising. So this basic truth that different conditions, circumstances converge to produce some, say, outcome, but that makes it sound static. It produces some arising. And then when those conditions actually cease, that outcome starts to disintegrate. And he's saying that about our reactive emotions. Any reactive emotion that arises ceases when its causes and conditions are finished. Although it may be a temporary quenching, merely a temporary coolness, it is Nibbana, even if only temporarily. So this can be a great practice in our daily lives, just noticing when greed, aversion, and delusion have abated. What does that actually feel like in our heart and mind? What does that feel like in the body? Like being on the lookout for it, starting to notice, like, wow, I'm not agitated. The heart isn't inflamed right now. There's a sense of contentment. Maybe you experienced it during the guided meditation. Just a moment with the breath where you were quite content. The attention was just gathered and collected around an inhale. There's no greed. You weren't trying to push anything away. You were clearly knowing your experience. There wasn't any delusion, confusion, ignorance at play. You're just with the breath. Notice what that's like. We tend to overlook it because it can have a neutral quality to it. Can we be on the lookout for that? Actually see it, value it, bring mindfulness to it, and really learn to trust it. Because in those moments, you're in the terrain of the third noble truth, right? The cessation of dukkha through letting go of craving. This is so valuable. This is how we can play with this temporary Nibbana. So any reactive emotions that arises ceases when its causes and conditions are finished. Although it may be a temporary quenching, merely a temporary coolness, it is still Nibbana, even if only temporarily. Thus, there's a temporary Nibbana for those who can't yet avoid some defilement. It is this temporary Nibbana that sustains the lives of beings who continue hanging on to defilement. So defilements, just greed, the activity of greed, aversion, and delusion. Anyone can see that if the egoistic emotions existed night and day without any pause or rest, no life could endure it. If such a life didn't die, it would go crazy and then die in the end. You ought to consider carefully the fact that life can survive only because there are moments when the defilements don't roast it. These periods outnumber the times when the defilements blaze. Think of that. There are these moments of temporary coolness. When the heart is not inflamed by craving, And I love that he says, I'll just read it again. Anyone can see that if the egoistic emotions existed night and day without any pause or rest, no life could endure it. He's saying we would die. We would die if we were beset by greed, aversion, and delusion day, like all day long, all night long. If such a life didn't die, it would go crazy and then die in the end. So be on the lookout for these moments where greed, aversion, and delusion aren't present. Start to learn to trust it and appreciate it. Because through bringing mindfulness to this absence of greed, aversion, and delusion, bringing mindfulness and appreciation can actually start to grow. And we start to lose our taste and our fascination for running greed, aversion, and delusion. And we start to prefer peace, lack of agitation. So, in his writings, Venerable Inalio makes it clear that when we abide in compassion, the heart mind is temporarily liberated. It's called Chaito Vimutti. And I really love this passage around that describes compassion as a practice. I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind filled with compassion, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So this state of compassion, it's actually boundless. There are no limits. Like when the heart mind is actually resting in compassion and it's radiating out from your being, and you don't need to make it radiate. It just radiates of its own volition, right? It's the nature of all of the Brahmaviharas to just radiate naturally above, below, to the left, to the right, and front and back. And there are no limits. It can just this, it has this boundless nature. It's immeasurable. And the state of compassion in its boundless nature, it makes it difficult for the hindrances and the defilements to actually get a foothold in the heart mind. And I've experienced this sometimes where I'm abiding in, say, metta or compassion, and some little greedy thought will arise, or some little mean, aggressive thought will arise. And I'm just aware of it in that field of compassion without fueling it. I'll just see it dissolve right before my eyes, and it takes my breath away every time. And it's not something that I will. It's an outcome of the practice, and there's just so much gratitude. So when we rest in compassion, the defilements aren't there obscuring the heart. When the defilements aren't there obscuring our heart and mind, all these beautiful qualities can shine through, right? It's as if the responsiveness of compassion is finally allowed to move through unabashedly through the heart, and it fills our intentions, it fills our words, our actions, our bodies, our hands, and moves out into the world, blessing not only ourselves, but our loved ones, people that we come in contact with. Just by virtue of abiding in compassion, we're actually weakening the habit, the fascination with greed, aversion, and delusion, and planting the seeds for compassion to arise with more frequency in the future. It's a really pleasant abiding. This is a phrase that you hear in the sutta sometimes, especially in connection to the deeper absorptions. And compassion can actually be practiced as an absorption. You use it as your meditation object. And you're, isn't that wonderful that our hearts and our minds can gather and collect around this beautiful quality of compassion? And to abide in compassion is pleasant. I remember maybe a year and a half ago, I was in a practice meeting with a yogi, and they talked about all of the Brahmaviharas as a balm. And I think this speaks to compassion's very soothing and calming influence. And I think one of the reasons that compassion can feel so soothing as a balm is because there's a delight, even a joyous tone in the compassion. So I want to read something to you from Bryan Stevenson's memoir. Some of you know that I really am moved by Bryan Stevenson's work. He's an attorney and an activist. And through the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, it's a monument in Alabama that memorializes the victims of lynching. And it also takes you through a journey through the story of lived history of slavery, Jim Crow, and mass incarceration. So Bryan Stevenson and his colleagues at the Equal Justice Initiative, through this monument and through their work, are actually encouraging us here in the United States, at least, to reflect soberly on racial discrimination and terror, past and present, to ensure a more just future and present for everybody. And the work that they do is incredible at the Equal Justice Initiative. He has, and it's not just him, it's his colleagues. But Bryan Stevenson in particular. And what's wonderful is you can go on, I didn't know this was the service, but you can go listen to Supreme Court arguments. And he's argued before the Supreme Court six times. And gosh, you can just hear his intelligence. There are these justices, these nine justices who are experts on the law. And they're just throwing questions at him. And he's very nimble, so very immense intelligence. But that intelligence is rooted in a heart that is really concerned about the welfare and health of people that, as a society, we've relegated to the margins. So, just to give you a sense of who this human being is, as I said, he argued six cases before the Supreme Court. And I was shocked to read this. In our lifetime, we sentenced children 17 years and younger for really egregious crimes to death. And because of Bryan Stevenson and his colleagues at the Equal Justice Initiative, we don't do that anymore. You know, just think of that. Collectively, we are a little bit more compassionate, a little more just, slowly inching our way to making the 14th Amendment apply to all Americans. Starting to apply to all Americans. So Bryan Stevenson wrote a memoir called Just Mercy. And in that memoir, this is what he had to say about what sounds to me like this joyous tone inherent in compassion. Said, when I was a college student, I had a job working as a musician in a Black church in a poor section of West Philadelphia. At a certain point in the service, I would play the organ before the choir began to sing. The minister would stand, spread his arms wide, and say, "Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice. You just get the felt sense of the joy inherent in compassion. And in the context of compassion practice, that may not logically make sense, because the arising of compassion is the result of coming in contact with suffering, contact with difficulty, contact with that which is painful. And the focus of our mindfulness when cultivating compassion meditatively, it's not the suffering. It's the wish for freedom from the suffering, from the affliction. Now, this is from Venerable Inalio's Emptiness and Compassion in Early Buddhism. For those of you who are new to our Sangha and may not know who Venerable Inalio is, he's a monastic and scholar and dedicated practitioner whose area of study and interest is early Buddhism. So this is what he says about suffering and compassion. It says, drawing a clear distinction between the realization that others are suffering and the wish for them to be free from suffering is important, since mentally dwelling on the actual suffering would be contemplation of dukkha. There would be a contemplation of this first noble truth that Joseph spoke about earlier, and gradually coming to understand dukkha, this unreliability. And when that becomes the focus, we're no longer practicing compassion. We're doing a contemplation of dukkha. And this happens for us sometimes. We intend to cultivate compassion, but the mind starts to focus on all the difficulties and the hardship of the situation instead of and the heart starts to resonate with the dukkha. And this would happen for me sometimes. Suffering would become the focus. And after some time, it would wear away at my capacity to be mindful in a balanced way. And then I'd collapse into overwhelm or fatigue. I remember going into one of my practice meetings. It was actually with Philip. And I didn't know how to practice with compassion, because I would connect with the suffering and that would become the object of my mindfulness. And I'd feel overwhelmed and I'd start to cry, and then I would try to come back into balance with equanimity practice. So I'm describing this to him as if it's my compassion practice. And very compassionately, he looked at me and was like, "That's not compassion practice, sweetie." I didn't quite, it took me a while. It took me a while to kind of get, well, what is this compassion? How do we actually practice it? Because people would say it's so joyous. And I'm like, "Oh, we're coming in contact with dukkha. How is it joyous?" And it's joyous because in cultivating compassion through meditation, the heart does come in contact with suffering. But then the focus widens to include not only the pain, but the vision of freedom from that pain. And the vision of this freedom from that pain is actually joyous. Brian Stevenson talks about being invigorated by his work. This vision of freedom. And it's really, when you think about it, I feel like he's telling all of us, like, no matter what our children have done, we don't have to lock them away and lock them up and throw away the key. That there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way. There's got to be another way. And that other way is a joyous thing. It's this joyous vision of freedom. So Brian Stevenson and his colleagues at the Equal Justice Initiative, after the Supreme Court ruled in their favor in two cases, they weren't celebratory. They talk about feeling pretty somber and sober, because they realized that these children, although they wouldn't be sentenced to death, they would now die in prison. So he and his colleagues have been working in the appropriate cases to free some of these children who are now adults, who are sentenced to be executed. And this is what he has to say about that work. He says, "It's so clear to me that we are all more than the worst thing we've ever done. I think if someone tells a lie, they're not just a liar. And they should not have to go through life branded only a liar. I think if someone takes something, they're not just a thief. I think even if you kill someone, you're not just a killer. We can't do justice until we understand all the things you are. We can't do justice until we understand all the things that you are." He goes on to say, "We have a generation of kids, poor kids, that by the time that they're five, have trauma disorders. Now, what we're trying to do with these kids, work that he's doing, what we're trying to do with these kids is that we're trying to make them feel human again. When you're told that you're a prisoner, when you're told that you're worthless, when you're told that you've been condemned to die in prison, you're basically being told your life has so little meaning, so little purpose, so little value. We're not going to let you have that life. Can you hear the empathy in what, in his words? He's using his imagination in an ethical way. He's using his imagination to empathize, to actually understand what it must be like to be in those conditions as a young person. And by using his imagination in this ethical way, and by that I just mean like imagining being in their circumstances, it helps to mitigate our reactivity so that we can start to resonate with what they're going through. And it gives us the opportunity for compassion to arise. So there's this relationship between empathy and compassion. They're not the same, but empathy can actually help us to imagine what it's like internally to be in those circumstances. Doesn't mean we condone the behavior, but we understand that the dukkha, the inner pain that has led to whatever it is. And instead of reactivity, there's this wish to alleviate pain, this vision of freedom, which is a joyous thing. It's empathy conditioning compassion. So Brian Stevenson goes on to say, "And you know, for me, it's allowing people to be human despite the tragedy of a past crime, or despite the tragedy of the injustice, despite the tragedy of what we've done to people." This passage exemplifies that when we make contact with suffering and arouse empathy through using our imagination in a moral way, we can allow sati to just rest with and know this vision of freedom from pain. That's compassion. And then we can take action if the conditions support us in doing so. And this is actually the wish, the genuine wish of compassion fueling compassionate action, anukampa. I just want to close with some of Brian Stevenson's words about this anukampa. He said, "Getting close, getting proximate changed him. Getting close, getting proximate to dukkha changed him." And he talks about how compassionate action animated his life. So we'll just close with his words. "That I went to law school because I was concerned about inequality and injustice. And it didn't seem like those were priorities in my first year of law school. And it was really only in my second year of law school that things turned around. I drove down to Jackson, Georgia, which is where death row is, And they brought this man in, and he had chains everywhere. And they had to unchain this man. And I got so nervous that when he walked over to me, I just said, "I'm so sorry. I'm just a law student. I don't know anything about the death penalty. I don't know anything about criminal procedure, but they sent me down here to tell you that you're not at risk of execution anytime in the next year." Brian Stevenson goes on to say, "I will never forget what that man said. That man just slowing me down and saying, 'Wait, wait, wait. Say that again.'" And I said, "You're not at risk of execution anytime in the next year." And he closed his eyes and he said, "Wait, wait, say that again." And I said, "You're not at risk of execution anytime in the next year." And that's when that man grabbed my hand and looked me dead in the eye and said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." And I couldn't believe how, even in my ignorance, just being present, just showing up could make a difference in the quality of someone's life. And it taught me something really important about being present, about proximity. And then Brian Stevenson has this memory of this man singing. And this man saying, I'm pressing on the upward way. New heights I'm gaining every day. Still praying as I'm onward bound. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground." Here's this condemned man given a reprieve, singing, "I'm pressing on the upward way. New heights I'm gaining every day. Still praying as I'm onward bound. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground." And Brian Stevenson says, "When I heard that man singing, everything changed for me. That's when I knew I wanted to help condemned people get to higher ground." There isn't a right way to act compassionately in the world. As Joseph Goldstein likes to remind us, there isn't a hierarchy among compassionate action. That the way compassion will actually move through you will be an expression of your values, your gifts, your interests, your resources like time and energy. The call for all of us is to alleviate dukkha where and if we can, just guided by this vision of freedom from suffering, and that it can be a joyous thing, that it can be delightful, that it can be a pleasant abiding, and that the development of meditative compassion helps fuel and gives rise to compassionate action in the world. So much more to say about compassionate action, but I think we'll leave it there for now. Just want to dedicate the merit to anyone who's in pain or difficulty right now. May they know that they're not alone. May they know that even if we can't fully change the conditions, the painful conditions that we're in, that we can actually bear the challenges when we call on our own capacity to meet it with some tenderness, some care. This genuine wish to just be free from suffering, or to have it alleviated, mitigated.